We'll go ahead and get started.
You're listening to the Dateline Morning Meeting.
When did the murder happen?
Our producers are swapping tips and story ideas.
The undercover cop said she is the mastermind behind this.
We're hoping that the sister will have some information.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly. I'm NBC News senior legal correspondent Laura Jarrett in for Andrea Canning. It's August 6th, and here's what's on our docket. In Las Vegas, for nearly 30 years, the murder of rap legend Tupac Shakur went unsolved. Now, the man accused of orchestrating his death is set to go on trial.
So what authorities are saying is, you said it in your own words. It's kind of tantamount to a confession.
In Dateline Roundup, Corey Richens, the Utah mom who wrote a children's book about grief and was then convicted of murdering her husband, is back in court. And we'll bring you the latest testimony from the trial of Lindsay Clancy, the labor and delivery nurse accused of killing her own children.
I did ask her her mood.
And what did she write?
She wrote horrified.
Plus, we've all seen Amber Alerts flash across our phones. But long before we had such high-tech tools telling us kids were missing, we put their photos on milk cartons. An expert from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children gives us the backstory.
Anderson Erickson Derry stepped in and said, we're gonna do something a little out of the box here.
But before all that, we're heading to Florida for a major development in the case of an OnlyFans model accused of murdering her boyfriend. On the afternoon of April 3rd, 2022, 25-year-old Courtney Clenny called 911, begging for help. She said her boyfriend was dying. The paramedics raced to her apartment and found 27-year-old Christian Obamseli lying in the hallway. He'd been fatally stabbed.
Apologies for being absolutely covered in blood.
Listen, you don't have to apologize.
Courtney told police she had stabbed Christian in self-defense.
I grabbed my knife and I said, don't come anywhere closer to me. I had to come at me, and I threw it.
But investigators didn't believe her story, and she was charged with second-degree murder. Courtney pleaded not guilty and over the past 4 years has insisted she's the real victim. It looked like she was heading to trial this month. Then suddenly last week, everything changed. Here to bring us up to speed is Dateline producer Lynn Keller. Lynn, thanks so much for being back on the podcast.
Hi, Laura.
Before we get into this new development, let's go back to the beginning here. Remind us who exactly Courtney Clenny is and what was her relationship like with Christian?
So Courtney was a model on OnlyFans, and she had built a huge online following, particularly Instagram. I think she had 2 million followers. She was making really good money. Prosecutors estimated that she earned approximately $3 million from OnlyFans during 2020 and 2021 combined. And she and Christian had started dating in 2020. He kind of dabbled a little bit in trading cryptocurrency. And on social media, she would often post pictures of the two of them together. You could sort of glimpse at their glamorous lifestyle, fancy cars and luxurious vacations.
Despite that glamour from the outside, though, Lynn, the relationship was far from perfect. It was violent at times. There was a lot going on even before that incident in 2022, right?
Yeah, that's right. Neighbors at this luxury apartment that they were living in had repeatedly complained about their loud arguments. And at the time of Christian's death, according to investigators, building management was actually preparing eviction proceedings because of those disturbances.
Yeah, that's not something that happens from one isolated incident. So bring us up to April 3rd of 2022. What do investigators say happened that day?
According to the arrest affidavit, their day actually began peacefully. Courtney and Christian, they spent the morning playing with their dogs. Christian left to pick up sandwiches, and he returned to the apartment shortly after 4:30 in the afternoon. And then Courtney ends up calling 911 at 4:57. So in that 20-plus minute window is where the stabbing took place.
So Courtney, what was her version of events?
So what she says to police is that Christian went to get the sandwiches, and she noticed that he had stopped sharing his location with her. So when he got back, she asked him to turn it back on, and he agreed. But when he asked her to do the same thing, she hesitated. And then she says he got angry and pinned her up against the wall. At some point, she's able to get away. She calls her mother and she starts going into different rooms and he starts following her. And then at one point, she picks up the knife and she says, don't come any closer.
Let's listen to what she says happens next.
And then he just charged at me. And I threw it, but he was far away, but I was scared because he was coming at me. He just choked me
twice. So you threw the knife at him?
Yeah. But I was so scared.
What made investigators suspicious of her story?
Well, according to the arrest affidavit, there were no significant injuries observed on Courtney consistent with the attack she describes. And then investigators had also questioned whether her story about throwing the knife matched the forensic evidence. Courtney told detectives she threw the knife from about 10 feet away, but according to the medical examiner, the wound was too deep. The knife had penetrated skin, muscle, and punctured Christian's artery.
So basically, it's just not physically possible to throw a knife across the room and do all that damage.
Well, that's what the prosecutors say, but the defense did their own experiment where they got a pig carcass and they had someone throw a knife at the pig carcass. And they said that the angle and the depth was consistent with Courtney's story.
Hmm. So investigators, they unearth all these other incidents that they say prove Courtney had a history of physical abuse with Courtney as the aggressor. Tell us what we know about that.
Well, the first thing that the prosecutor showed when they had their press conference announcing the arrest was a clip of security cam footage from the elevator inside Courtney's apartment building. And this was about 6 weeks before the stabbing. And it shows Courtney repeatedly striking Christian when he got in the elevator. She's wailing on him. And he at one point puts her in a loose headlock to try to, I guess, stop her from doing that. But we should know that the defense argued that that clip was taken out of context. They say that what's not clear in that video is that she gets on that elevator to go down to the lobby to call the police because they were in a fight. And in fact, she was cut and bleeding.
So Courtney's defense team has pushed back hard here, saying she is the real victim.
Yes. They're trying to show that this was not a one-sided abuse situation. In a motion to reconsider bond, the defense describes an incident just a few days before Christian's death when Courtney can be seen on Miami police body cam video asking for a restraining order against Christian. They also have body cam video of a neighbor who a week before says that he sees Christian punching Courtney.
So Courtney's trial was on the docket for this month, but late last week, you got word about a major development. What changed for Courtney?
Courtney has agreed to take a plea deal.
Do we know what factored into that decision, given how hard she's been fighting this since her arrest?
I would just have to guess. I feel like it's such a he said, she said case. We're not dealing with DNA. We're not dealing necessarily with facts. It seems very strong in opinions. And so possibly she just did not want to roll the dice with a jury.
Do we know about the terms of the deal at all?
They are going to be made public on August 10th.
So do we know anything about what the possible charges are on the table for her?
Well, she was charged with second degree murder. So I'm pretty sure we can guess that that is not what she's going to plead guilty to. So I think it's a pretty safe bet that she probably would plead to manslaughter. And then it's going to be a negotiation about how much time. So in manslaughter in Florida, the guidelines would be just over 9 years. She's already served 4 years.
Lynn, what do we know about how Christian's family has been doing? This has been a long road. What do we know about how they're holding up?
They're a very strong family. They're very close-knit. I do believe that the family has been consulted about the deal. I don't think in Florida they have any kind of power over whether or not the deal happens, but I'm sure the state's attorney is considering their feelings.
Well, hopefully this deal will start the process of getting some closure in this case. Lynn Keller, thank you for all your work on this. Appreciate the update.
Thanks, Laura.
Coming up, he was the most famous rapper in the world, gunned down at the age of 25. 30 years later, the man accused of orchestrating Tupac Shakur's murder is heading to trial. For our next story, we're headed to the Las Vegas Strip, where 30 years ago, Tupac Shakur, one of hip-hop's biggest stars, was gunned down when he was sitting in a car at a stoplight. He was just 25 years old. For decades, the case has spawned countless theories about who might really have killed Tupac. But investigators didn't seem any closer to getting answers until September of 2023. The Clark County Sheriff and the Clark County DA finally had news.
We are here today to announce the arrest of 60-year-old Dwayne Keith Davis, a.k.a. Keefy D, for the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Prosecutors accused Davis, a former gang leader, of orchestrating Tupac's murder and procuring the gun that killed him. And they said the breakthrough in their 27-year case was Davis's own words about that night.
When we pulled up, I was in the front seat.
Davis has pleaded not guilty to charges, including first-degree murder. With his trial set to begin Monday, we asked NBC's senior investigative reporter, Andy Blankstein, to come on the podcast and break it all down for us. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Glad to be here, Laura. Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Andy, Tupac is one of the most influential rap artists of the 1990s. I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with his legacy and his music. But for those who may need a refresher, just remind us of his impact on the culture.
Well, Laura, he's a transcendent talent. I mean, there's no doubt about it, not only for the period that he's influencing rap in the 1990s, but beyond. As you said, it's a short career, but it's a legendary career. He sells millions of records worldwide. The music itself has deep impact on the culture, deeply personal lyrics, commentary on what was going on out there, race, poverty, injustice.
Remind us what exactly we know about the night of that shooting and how it all went down.
So Tupac is riding in a BMW with Marion Shug Knight, CEO, co-founder of Death Row Records. And it's the company that Tupac is signed with. They're on the way to a nightclub after attending a Mike Tyson fight at the MGM Grand Casino. Shug is driving. Tupac is in the passenger seat. And according to prosecutors, a white Cadillac pulls alongside them at a stoplight. Shots are fired. Shug is injured. Tupac is shot four times. He's taken to the hospital. He lingers from those injuries, but eventually dies 6 days later.
Investigators learned pretty quickly, even at that time, that Tupac and Shug Knight had gotten into some sort of altercation earlier that day.
So witnesses tell them about a brawl that takes place in the MGM Grand Casino. And Tupac and Shug are seen punching a man by the name of Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, who, as it turns out, is a member of the Crips gang in Los Angeles. And that raises this possibility that Anderson was behind the shooting and he'd gone looking for Tupac to get his revenge.
And for a bit more context here, Andy, according to one of the detectives on the case, Shug Knight was affiliated with a gang too, the Mob Piru, and they were feuding with the Crips. But that lead goes cold a few years later when Orlando dies in an unrelated shooting.
Yeah, it makes it very difficult for police that kind of the person who's the alleged trigger man in this dies in what was described in the time in news reports was that it was a gang-related killing. And these cases, when you talk about gang-related violence, it makes it much more difficult for police to kind of investigate these cases because they are essentially, you know, you have trouble getting witnesses to speak up. So that becomes very quickly, I wouldn't say a dead end, but it goes cold.
The other backdrop to this, of course, that's going on at the time is sort of this infamous rivalry, if you will, between the East Coast and West Coast rappers, right? And that was always sort of one of the backdrops to both the killing of Tupac and Biggie, the Notorious B.I.G.
So you're already talking about kind of edgy music that's skating on the edge of life on the streets that is gritty and violent. And there are artists that are rising out of that. Obviously, you have kind of the West Coast gangster rap scene. On the flip side of that, as you mentioned, Laura, you know, on the East Coast, Sean Combs and Bad Boy Records and Biggie Smalls, obviously kind of the most recognizable artist. And there's this kind of jocularity and kind of trash talking, but that eventually spills over into violence.
Andy, for years, there's been all this speculation that Sean Diddy Combs might have actually played a role in Tupac's murder as part of that East Coast, West Coast rivalry. He's always denied that and has never been charged with a crime related to Tupac's death.
That's right. One of the things people forget is the killings of Tupac and Biggie are only 6 months apart in 1996 into 1997. The speculation is that there's a revenge factor that's being ordered up from the top. That never really plays out in anything, but in terms of people talking about it and the rumor mill, it's ever present.
So the case languishes for years. We then come to 2023, and the Las Vegas police announced that they had arrested Dwayne Keefe D. Davis. Andy, tell us about what do we know about Davis, who he is, why did investigators zero in on him in particular?
So Keefe D. Davis, Dwayne Davis, is the uncle of Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, who is the alleged shooter. And in 2009, the LAPD and others on a task force investigating gang violence and drug trafficking sit down and talk to Davis to ask him what he knows in kind of a non-prosecution agreement, a proffer, if you will. And in this proffer, Davis agrees to tell them what he knows. And he's not the trigger man, but he lays out kind of what happened that night.
Does he say he was in the car?
He was one of the four people in the car.
So one of the things that's just incredible, Andy, is that the prosecutors couldn't go after Davis back then because if they had wanted to, the proffer agreement protected him. But then Davis decides to tell other people he was in the car that night. He writes about it in his memoir, Compton Street Legend, and talks about it in interviews like this one he gives to BET's Death Row Chronicles. Take a listen to this.
You said the shots came from the back. Big Dre, Orlando. Who shot Tupac?
The keeper for the code of the streets. It just came from the back seat, bro.
So that puts him in a position of knowledge about where the shots came from.
That's right. And so what authorities are saying is, you said it in your own words. It's kind of tantamount to a confession.
His defense team is obviously pushing back against all of this. What is their theory of the case, Andy?
You know, one is, so since this happened 30 years ago, you didn't have physical evidence that really, in terms of a gun, ballistics, DNA, the things that juries actually look for, not only don't you have the goods as far as forensics and physical evidence, but this talk about in the book, well, that's kind of embellishment. These are stories. So you can't have one without the other. If you're going to prosecute this case, where's the other evidence?
So with the trial now expected to formally start with jury selection on Monday, what are you watching for the most?
You know, you've seen documentaries and books and magazine articles. And all these years later, it continues to kind of fascinate people and it continues to kind of generate more discussions. And I think the latest incarnation of that is going to be seen in this trial, the latest chapter.
That's very interesting. Andy Blankstein, NBC senior investigative reporter. Thank you so much for joining, Andy.
Laura, thank you so much.
Up next, it's time for Dateline Roundup. Updates from the murder trial of the former labor and delivery nurse, Lindsay Clancy. And Corey Richens is back in court. Plus, how the faces of missing children wound up on milk cartons. Hello and welcome back to Dateline Roundup. Today, I am joined by Dateline producer Mike Nardi. Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So to start, we're going to check in on the trial of Lindsay Clancy, the Massachusetts mom who jumped out of a second-story window after killing her three children. Now, prosecutors have charged her with murder. She's pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. It's just a heartbreaking case, Mike. Bring us up to speed on the latest.
It is. It is, Laura. So this week, Lindsay's mental state has taken center stage. Remember, her defense is arguing that Lindsay's struggle with postpartum depression and the cocktail of drugs she'd been prescribed propelled her into psychosis. The prosecution has argued she really wasn't that sick and was aware of what she was doing, even that she planned the deaths. And to show that, this week, the prosecution called medical professionals and psychiatrists to testify.
So one of those witnesses was a doctor who actually treats Lindsay in the ICU where she's taken after jumping out of that window. What did the doctor have to say about her state of mind when she was in the hospital?
So this doctor said that Lindsay could only communicate by writing on a whiteboard. And here's what that doctor says happened when she was communicating with Lindsay.
I did ask her her mood.
And what did she write?
She wrote horrified. She wrote down, do I have an attorney? We asked her, do you have questions for us? And she asked, is my body broken? Are my legs straight?
And this moment with the whiteboard is a big deal for the prosecution. They're arguing that by asking about an attorney, Lindsay had, quote, the mental acumen to protect her own rights and interests. Essentially that she knew what she did was wrong, not that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis.
Also for the first time in this trial, Lindsay Clancy herself spoke in court. This was before testimony got underway on Tuesday. Here she is speaking to the judge.
Do you understand by signing or going along with that stipulation, you are basically relieving the Commonwealth of its burden to prove those certain facts? Do you understand that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what you want to do at this point?
Yes.
So, Mike, explain for people who might not be familiar what this type of stipulation does.
Well, so essentially she won't contest certain facts in her case. And these facts are related to the chain of custody of evidence.
So, and one of the reasons you would do that is it speeds things along. There's no point in going through some of, you know, more of the gory details for things that she just doesn't contest.
Right, right. They're just agreeing that the chain of evidence is a fact. So the prosecutors can move through their case much more quickly now.
It is a heart-wrenching case, as we said, and we know you're going to be certainly following along. For our next story, we've got the latest in the University of Idaho student murders case. It's been over a year since Brian Koberger pleaded guilty in open court to the 2022 killings of Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zanna Kernodle. But last week, something stunning happened. Koberger is trying to undo his plea deal. He filed a petition with the court to challenge that guilty plea and conviction.
Right. So he's serving four life sentences for the murders, and now he's saying he's innocent and wants to go to trial. In this petition, he's suggesting that his former attorneys provided ineffective assistance of counsel and coerced him into taking a guilty plea. NBC News has reached out to those attorneys for comment and has not heard back.
What's wild about it is, having covered that case since the beginning, is just knowing how many motions his prior public defender filed on his behalf and how vigorously she litigated at that case. It'll be fascinating to see if she ever speaks out on all of this. Meantime, the family of Kaylee Gonsalves sat down with Craig Melvin on the Today Show and shared their reaction to the news of Koberger's filing.
They did. Kaylee's father, Steve, expressed his frustration, but he wasn't against a trial.
Would you actually like to see this go to trial this time around?
That's never changed. I've been consistent through and through. The evidence was there. I want to honor all the work that the agents did.
And Mike, sitting next to the parents of Kaylee Gonsalves for that interview was someone we'd never heard before, her younger sister, Aubrey.
Right. And she told Craig about why she decided to break her silence now after all this time. She referred to both Kaylee and Madison Mogan, who was Kaylee's best friend, as her sisters.
When everything happened, I was a sophomore in high school. And at the time, I kind of just decided that no words were going to bring back either one of my sisters. So I didn't feel like saying anything. And now that I've gotten older, I realize still that no words are going to bring back my sisters, but words are what's going to keep their memories alive.
It just must be so confoundingly painful for these parents who thought this case was over, who thought they could finally put this entire nightmare behind them, and now to have it reopened all again. Even if it's legally unlikely to go anywhere, they still have to go through all of this.
Right, right. Just must be awful for them.
Finally, Mike, there's news out of Utah in the case of Corey Richens. People remember the mom of three who wrote that children's book about grief after her husband Eric's death, only to be convicted of his murder earlier this year. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, but her case marches on. So, Mike, what's the latest there?
So Corey was in court to address a motion her team filed back in June. They asked for the judge who presided over Corey's murder trial, Judge Richard Mrazek, to be disqualified and for Corey to be granted a new trial. In their motion, lawyers said Judge Mrazek was allegedly impatient, critical, hostile, disparaging, and condescending toward defense counsel, and in contrast, was friendly and helpful to the prosecution. So they're saying this could have prejudiced the jury and made the trial unfair.
Last week's hearing was actually with a different judge. So how did she rule on that motion?
This judge denied the motion. So Corey's conviction was upheld and Judge Mrazek won't be removed from the case.
We've mentioned before on the podcast, Corey has several other criminal charges hanging over her head, all involving money. In 2025, she's charged with various financial felonies, including money laundering and mortgage fraud. She's pleaded not guilty to those charges. And the next hearing in that case is scheduled for October 9th, and we will, of course, be keeping tabs on that. Mike Nardi, thank you so much for all the updates.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Last week, Josh was on the show to talk about the latest season of his podcast series, Dateline Missing in America, and it got us thinking about how we usually find out about someone who has gone missing. It can be anything from urgent Amber Alerts that flash across our phones or TV screens to even viral TikToks nowadays. But back in the day, looking for people wasn't so high-tech. You might see flyers taped to lampposts or hear about a case on the local news, but perhaps the most surprising method of all, photos of missing kids that were printed on the back of milk cartons. My next guest is Dr. John Bischoff, head of the Missing Children's Division within the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He's here to tell us the story behind the milk carton campaign and what happened to it. Dr. Bischoff, welcome and thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
So from reading and listening to so many missing persons cases on Dateline, I bet our audience has a sense that the most important factor in determining whether somebody is found is exposure. And today, social media helps us with this in maybe the best ways that social media can be used. But back in the early 80s and the 90s, we didn't have that. And so who decided that printing faces on milk cartons was the best way to get exposure?
You know, it was certainly an interesting time. Back in the 1980s, you had a lot of highly publicized missing child incidents. It was actually an organization, Iowa's Anderson Erickson Dairy, launched the first milk carton campaign in the mid-1980s. And you might be thinking, why? Why did they do this? You had Eugene Martin and Johnny Gosch. They were paper boys in Des Moines, Iowa, and they went missing. So Anderson Erickson Dairy stepped in and said, we're gonna do something a little out of the box here, right? We're gonna put missing child images on milk cartons. We supplied them, right? Because we were just starting as a nonprofit organization and we had the missing child images.
So it does go national eventually.
Yes. It expanded to nearly 700 dairy manufacturers over the years, which really pushed this to be a nationwide initiative. We were hitting breakfast tables all over the United States with images of missing children, descriptive information, and then what to do, where to call.
But that's also, I think, one of the reasons it started to draw some critics as well, right? Bringing those conversations to the breakfast table can be scary.
It absolutely can. It had a frightening impact. The term that was used was stranger danger. And honestly, the whole concept, you know, talking about that over the breakfast table, there were better ways to do that. It also overrepresented the issue itself. Today, less than 1%, it's about 0.5% of our missing child cases that we assist law enforcement with are non-family abductions. So we're talking about a very small percentage. And that's probably one of the reasons why the program as a whole started to dwindle out in the late 80s.
So the milk carton campaign only found two children the entire time that it was actually in place. We did come up with some more effective methods. What do you think are some of the lessons that were learned from the campaign that have sort of carried over into things like the Amber Alert system?
The milk carton campaign was the first step towards modern mass distribution of missing child information. It challenged everyone to ask the simple question, where else can we put missing child images to help find them, right? We're never done building this system, and rightfully so. But today we have social media, different billboard systems that we have access to that we can help push information to. Tools like we've got a QR code that will show you missing children within 50 miles of where your IP address resolves to. You can go to our interactive map and find all that information at the touch of your fingertips. We want our data out there. And, you know, let's face it, the milk carton campaign was really one of the first steps in mass distribution of missing child posters. When you see a missing child poster, know that how that poster got to where you saw it was started way back from dairy farmers.
Dr. Bischoff, thank you so much for joining us today and all of the important work that you are doing every day on behalf of missing children.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Dateline True Crime Weekly. But check out the latest season of the Webby Award-winning podcast, Dateline Missing in America. Josh Mankiewicz is taking a look at six new cases. The first two episodes are out now. To get early access to new episodes and listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium. Coming up this Friday on Dateline, Keith takes us to Silver City, New Mexico, where 23-year-old Cassie Farrington was found dead in her own bathtub. Her family had their suspicion about who did it.
He did it. He killed her. We know he did.
Watch Suspicion in Silver City, Friday at 10, 9 Central on Dateline on NBC. Thanks so much for listening. Dateline True Crime Weekly is produced by Carson Cummins, Caroline Casey, and Kiani Reed. Our associate producers are Ellery Gladstone Groth and Aria Young. Our senior producer is Liz Brown Kurloff. Production and fact-checking help by Yana Johnson. Veronica Mazeka is our digital producer. Rick Kwan is our sound designer. Original music by Jesse McGinty. Paul Ryan is executive producer, and Liz Cole is senior executive producer of Dateline.
Have a great day.